Imagine you just served 10 years. Like you've done the time.
Right. You've paid your debt to society.
Exactly.
But
And while you were inside, you kept your head down, you took whatever vocational courses were available to you, and you actually mastered a trade.
let's say you became a really, really skilled barber.
Yeah, an exceptionally skilled barber. And then the day finally comes, the gates open, you step out, and you're ready to work, you know, ready to pay taxes, ready to just be a functional part of society again.
You're doing everything we ask people to do.
Right, so you walk into the state licensing board to get your official occupational license so you can legally cut hair. And the person at the desk looks at your record and just says, "Sorry, your past conviction legally bars you from holding a cosmetology license in this state."
Wow.
Yeah, you are legally banned from practicing the exact trade the state just spent 10 years teaching you.
It is the ultimate systemic paradox.
Right.
We demand reintegration, right? But we engineer these structural blockades that make that reintegration basically mathematically impossible.
Well, welcome to the deep dive. We are so glad you are here with us today. This is a custom-tailored journey just for you, and we are venturing into the really complex and honestly, often entirely hidden mechanics of what happens after those prison gates open.
And, how we might prevent people from being sent behind them in the first place.
Exactly. We have taken an enormous stack of resources for this one. We're talking research from the Vera Institute of Justice, statistical analyses from the RAND Corporation, insights from the Sentencing Project, the Collateral Consequences Resource Center, and just a wide array of academic and news
A
articles.
lot of material.
It is, but our mission is to pull apart the gears of this system. We're getting into the real mechanics of reentry, legal reform, and restorative justice.
And we're doing this because, well, knowledge has to be applied. Understanding these systems is crucial because how a society handles second chances, how it manages reintegration, that dictates the public safety of the neighborhood you live in.
Yeah, your actual neighborhood.
Right. It dictates the economic vitality of your local businesses and just the overall well-being of your community.
So let's start right at the threshold of release. There's a term from a report we looked at in CT Insider, and they were analyzing the lasting financial, health, and housing hardships faced by formerly incarcerated individuals. The phrase they use is civic death.
Civic death. Yeah, that's a heavy term.
It really is.
Because when we think of a sentence ending, society generally assumes it's a clean break. The debt is paid, you go home.
You start over.
Right. But the reality is that the punishment just shifts. It moves from physical confinement to administrative exclusion. And legally, these are defined as collateral consequences.
Okay, let's get really specific about those collateral consequences, because I think a lot of people I know, I did assume it just means having a hard time getting like a corporate job.
Yeah, background check issue.
Exactly. But we looked at the National Inventory of Collateral Consequences of Conviction. This is tracked by the National Reentry Resource Center, and we're not talking about a handful of vague societal stigmas.
Not at all.
We are talking about thousands of codified legal restrictions.
Tens of thousands nationwide, actually.
Wait, tens of thousands?
Yes. And they attach automatically to a conviction, and they follow a person indefinitely. They restrict housing, occupational licenses, like we talked about, civic participation, and even access to basic social safety nets.
And what makes this so difficult to comprehend is how hidden it is from our everyday economic indicators. Like, we all watch the national unemployment numbers, right?
Sure, the Musley Jobs Report.
Right. But the Vera Institute points out this profound statistical distortion. People who are currently in jail and prison, and often those entirely locked out of the formal labor market upon release, they are largely erased from how we calculate our true economic health.
They just fall out of the denominator.
Right.
Because if you aren't actively seeking work because you are incarcerated, or if you've completely given up because of these thousands of legal barriers, you are not counted as unemployed.
Which means our official statistics present a really sanitized version of the labor market.
Highly sanitized. But if you look at the Prison Policy Initiative, their data shows that the labor market penalty for having a record is just devastating. Formerly incarcerated individuals face unemployment rates that rival the Great Depression.
Wow. And I want to look at how that ripples outward, because the Vera Institute data on gender inequality highlights something we rarely discuss.
The family impact.
Exactly. It's not just the individual suffering this civic death. Women connected to incarcerated or formerly incarcerated partners bear an immense economic and caregiving burden.
They absolutely do.
They're the ones absorbing the shock of this systemic exclusion.
It forces families into an impossible position. I mean, think about it. If the returning citizen cannot secure employment, the financial pressure falls entirely on their family network.
And that network is often already totally depleted.
Right. From the costs associated with the incarceration itself, the phone calls, the commissary, the legal fees. So when employment is blocked, the debt from court fines and fees just compounds.
So recidivism rises not necessarily out of malice, but out of sheer economic desperation.
Exactly. It's survival.
Okay, let's unpack this and break down the specific barriers that create that desperation. Starting with the most fundamental human need, which is shelter. The Vera Institute literally refers to the current system as a criminalization to homelessness pipeline.
And the mechanics of that pipeline are entirely predictable, unfortunately. You're released, often with nothing more than the clothes on your back and a bus ticket.
Right.
You need a place to live. But background checks are standard for nearly all rental applications now.
Yeah, everywhere you go.
So a past conviction, even one from decades ago, routinely triggers an automatic denial from landlords and property management companies.
And the Prison Policy Initiative data bears this out completely. Formerly incarcerated people are vastly more likely to experience homelessness. And, you know, if you don't have a safe place to sleep, how are you supposed to manage every other requirement of your parole?
You can't. Finding a job, attending mandated treatment, meeting your parole officer, it all becomes impossible if you are sleeping in your car or on the street.
It's like being asked to run a hurdle race, but the hurdles actually get higher after you cross the finish line.
That is a great way to put it.
So how is anyone supposed to reintegrate when the basic building blocks of life are systematically withheld?
Well, this is why the sources point toward highly tailored housing interventions. A generalized homeless shelter often just cannot address the overlapping vulnerabilities of reentry.
Right, like the example of Aries Madison's starter house in Atlanta.
Yes. That program is a perfect illustration of targeted intervention. It specifically serves formerly incarcerated Black trans women.
Which is such a specific and vulnerable demographic.
Exactly. And it doesn't just provide a bed. It combines housing with health services, psychological support, and economic empowerment.
We also looked at Hope House, run by the Ladies of Hope Ministries. They provide safe housing for women returning from incarceration, and they operate on the premise that trauma recovery and long-term stability are fundamentally linked to stable housing.
You can't just drop someone into an apartment and consider the job done.
Right. The intersectionality is key. A reentry program has to acknowledge that a woman returning from prison faces totally different vulnerabilities than a man.
A transgender woman faces an entirely distinct set of compounding risks on top of that.
Okay, so assuming someone miraculously navigates the housing barrier, they still need to generate income. We talked about the barbering example earlier. The report from the Institute for Justice titled Barred from Working is just maddening.
It's incredibly frustrating to read.
They call occupational licensing a second prison. How widespread is this?
It is ubiquitous. Mm. Nearly a quarter of all jobs in the United States require a government-issued license.
A quarter of all jobs?
Yes. And we aren't just talking about doctors or lawyers. We are talking about HVAC technicians, plumbers, cosmetologists, pest control workers.
Everyday trades.
Exactly.
Wow.
The Institute for Justice documented how states routinely use good moral character clauses to deny licenses to anyone with a record.
Regardless of what the record actually is.
Right. Regardless of whether their past offense has any relevance whatsoever to the profession they're applying for.
That is the part that defies logic to me. If someone has a decades-old conviction for drug possession, how does that logically disqualify them from safely installing an air conditioner?
It doesn't. But the statutes are written so broadly that licensing boards have blanket authority to deny applicants.
So it creates a scenario where the state is spending taxpayer money to run vocational training inside the prison.
Yes.
Only for a different branch of the same state government to legally bar the person from utilizing that training upon release.
It's a complete Ouroboros of bureaucracy.
It's wild. And it trickles down to even more basic logistics. We read about a program in Michigan expanding efforts to provide state IDs to people leaving jail.
Which seems like a no-brainer.
Right. You would think someone leaving state custody would automatically be handed a state ID. I mean, the state had them locked up. Obviously, the state knows who they are.
You would assume so. But the administrative silos are incredibly deep. Many people leave facilities without valid identification.
And without an ID, you cannot sign a lease. You cannot open a bank account. You cannot formally apply for a job.
You can't even get past the security desk of some government buildings to attend your mandated check-ins.
Which could then violate your parole.
Exactly. And another Vero report highlighted transportation as a critical derailer. If your license was suspended, or you can't afford a car, and you are paroled to an area with zero public transit, the structural friction is immense.
So we do see some fascinating grassroots solutions trying to bypass these roadblocks. The All Square model in Minneapolis really stood out in the sources.
Ah, the grilled cheese shop.
Yes, the grilled cheese shop. But let's dig into the mechanics of why a grilled cheese shop actually reduces recidivism. Because they don't just hand formerly incarcerated individuals a spatula and say, good luck.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
All Square operates as a social enterprise. They hire individuals who have experienced the justice system for a fellowship.
Okay.
But the employment is coupled directly with intensive professional development, therapy, and entrepreneurship training.
So they are essentially paying them to stabilize their lives while working.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by placing them in a highly public-facing, successful local business, it challenges the societal stigma. Every time a customer walks in and interacts with the staff, it chips away at the narrative of the dangerous ex-con.
There's a similar ethos in the Denver barbershop profiled by Axios, right? They intentionally remove second chance hiring barriers.
Yeah, it's about changing the community mindset from the ground up.
I love those programs. I really do. But I have to play devil's advocate here.
Go for it.
A grilled cheese shop in Minneapolis and a barbershop in Denver are incredible for the 50 or 100 people they employ.
Sure.
But we are talking about millions of people facing systemic, legally codified lockouts. Grassroots entrepreneurship cannot fix a nationwide legal blockade.
You are entirely correct.
Right.
Individual benevolence cannot outpace systemic exclusion.
Right.
If the barriers are written into law, the solutions must be legislated. Which transitions us to the national push for Clean Slate initiatives.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics of Clean Slate. The Collateral Consequences Resource Center tracks this deeply. Margaret Love's work outlines the core battle here, which is petition-based record clearing versus automatic record clearing.
This is a huge distinction. Currently, most states offer some form of record clearing or expungement if a person remains conviction-free for a certain number of years.
Right, but the default mechanism is a petition-based system.
Yes, which means the burden is entirely on the individual.
And the burden is astronomical, right.
Oh, it's vast. A petition-based system requires the individual to first realize they are eligible, which is legally complex in itself.
Just figuring out the timeline.
Exactly. Then they often have to hire an attorney, pay hundreds of dollars in filing fees, gather court documents from multiple jurisdictions, and attend formal hearings.
So society says, okay, you've served your time, you have stayed out of trouble for a decade, and you deserve a clean slate. But only if you have a few thousand dollars in disposable income and a law degree to figure out the paperwork.
That's exactly how it functions in practice. Research shows that only a tiny fraction of eligible people, sometimes less than 10%, ever actually make it through the petition process.
Less than 10%. That's a systemic failure.
It is. The Clean Slate movement argues that clearing a record shouldn't be a privilege reserved for those with capital and resources. It should be an automatic right upon completion of the statutory requirements.
So automatic clearing just means the computer system runs a script, sees the timeline has passed with no new arrests, and just seals it.
Yes. Because the government holds all the data anyway. The government knows when the eligibility date passes. Automatic laws require the state to proactively seal the record without forcing the individual to navigate a bureaucratic maze.
And we saw that this movement is gaining serious traction. The U.S. Senate passed resolutions declaring April as Second Chance Month in both 2025 and 2026.
Right, driven by heavy advocacy from groups like Prison Fellowship, Time Down, and Just Leadership USA.
But I need to push back on this on behalf of employers.
Okay.
Because if I own a logistics company and I am hiring drivers to transport valuable goods, don't I have a right to know if someone has a history of theft? Doesn't automatic clearing strip away vital risk assessment data from the public?
It is the most common critique of clean slate laws. Absolutely. But the data on recidivism timelines provides the counterweight to that fear. Actuarial studies show that if a person with a prior conviction remains crime-free in the community for a certain period, usually between 4 to 7 years, depending on the initial offense, their statistical risk of committing a new crime drops to the exact same level as a person in the general public who has never been arrested.
Wait, really? It drops to the exact same level?
The exact same level.
So the argument is that after a certain point, the record loses its predictive value. It stops being a risk indicator and just becomes an arbitrary punishment.
Precisely. If the statistical risk is identical to the general population, then forcing employers to weigh a decade-old conviction only facilitates prejudice, not safety.
Wow. That connects directly to another major policy intervention we reviewed, which is ban the box. The National Employment Law Project has been championing this for years.
Yes, the initiative to remove the checkbox on job applications that ask about criminal history.
And the logic there is to delay the background check until later in the hiring process, ideally after a conditional job offer has been made, right?
That's the intent.
The idea being that an applicant can actually get their foot in the door, demonstrate their qualifications, and maybe explain their past in an interview, rather than an automated tracking system immediately trashing their resume because they checked yes.
Right. However, as an audience that follows these policies deeply, we have to look at the unintended consequences of Ban the Box.
Yeah, the research is highly nuanced.
Very.
Because I was reading a study by researchers Agin and Starr that kind of threw a wrench into the whole Ban the Box narrative.
The statistical discrimination study. It is a critical piece of the puzzle. What Agin and Starr found was that when you force employers to remove the criminal history box, some employers, particularly in lower wage sectors, start relying on proxies to guess who might have a record.
Because they still want to avoid risk, but now they are flying blind.
Exactly. And the proxies they use are often highly discriminatory.
Right.
The study found that after Ban the Box was implemented in certain jurisdictions, callback rates for young black men with no criminal record actually dropped significantly.
That is horrifying, because the employer assumes a statistical probability based on race and zip code. They end up penalizing completely innocent applicants.
It really highlights the danger of simplistic policy interventions. Ban the Box removes a mechanical barrier, but it does not address the underlying societal prejudice against the formerly incarcerated.
Yeah, if the employer still harbors deep biases, delaying the question might just shift the mechanism of discrimination.
Exactly. This is why holistic reintegration requires more than just hiding the record. It requires fundamentally changing the skill profile of the person returning to the community.
Which is the perfect pivot to our next major area. We have talked extensively about altering the outside world, you know, wiping slates clean, removing housing barriers. But if you fix the outside world and release someone who has had zero preparation for the modern economy, the friction is still going to ignite.
Definitely.
We have to look at the classroom behind bars.
The landscape of prison education is undergoing a historic shift right now.
And we really have to start with the history to understand the magnitude of this shift. Specifically, the return of federal Pell Grants for incarcerated students.
Right. To understand this, we have to look back to the 1994 crime bill. Prior to that, college and prison programs were pretty robust. Incarcerated individuals could utilize Pell Grants, which is federal financial aid, for low-income students to pay for college courses.
But the 1994 legislation specifically stripped that eligibility away.
It effectively killed higher education in prisons overnight.
It decimated it. For 26 years, an entire generation of incarcerated people was completely locked out of federal financial aid for higher education.
But recent legislation finally restored that access.
Yeah, the articles in Inside Higher Ed track this rollout. It's a slow bureaucratic process, but the structural funding is finally back.
And the models that survived that 26-year drought are the ones that are emerging now. They challenge every preconceived notion we hold about correctional facilities.
I was blown away by the Hechinger report detailing the program run by Cal Poly Humboldt at Pelican Bay State Prison.
That's a fascinating example.
Because Pelican Bay isn't just any facility. Historically, it has been known as one of the most notoriously violent maximum security supermax environments in the country. And now, they are running a rigorous bachelor's degree program right in the middle of it.
We also looked at Mount Tamalpais College, which operates as an independent, fully accredited college situated entirely inside San Quentin State Prison in California.
It's not just a correspondence course where they slide packets under the door.
No, it is a physical campus environment operating within the prison walls.
And it spans all educational levels, too. The Washington Post reported on high school graduations happening inside the D.C. jail through the Maya Angelou Academy.
The details in that reporting were so moving.
Right, families coming in, watching their teenagers walk in graduation gowns inside a detention center. It completely rehumanizes the environment.
It does, but we have to address the modern reality of education here. A diploma is essential, yes, but in the current economy, it is insufficient on its own.
Right, you need technical fluency, you need digital literacy. Which brings us to the most complex paradox we found in the research.
The technology gap.
Yeah, here's where it gets really interesting. I like to think of it as trying to teach someone how to swim by having them read a book on dry land.
That's very accurate.
We expect people to be released and immediately apply for jobs online, navigate digital banking, use telehealth portals, and manage two-factor authentication. Yet they are spending years or decades in an environment explicitly designed to block internet access.
It's the ultimate tension between institutional security and necessary rehabilitation. We read a deeply insightful paper published on Arcalid Forf with the striking title, "The System Will Choose Security Over Humanity Every Time."
Let's dissect that paper because it really gets into the architecture of how technology is deployed in prisons.
So the authors investigate the recent influx of digital devices into correctional facilities specifically, tablets provided by private telecom companies like Securus or JPay.
And on the surface, giving incarcerated people tablets sounds like a huge leap forward for digital literacy.
It does. But the reality of how these tablets function is entirely different. They aren't iPads connected to the open web.
Not at all.
They are highly restricted, heavily monitored devices operating on closed networks. The paper details how these systems are often deeply monetized.
Yeah, users are charged by the minute to read public domain books or charged exorbitant fees to send electronic messages.
So they are learning how to use a proprietary walled garden interface designed to extract money from their families, not how to navigate the actual open internet.
Furthermore, the primary function of these devices, from the institution's perspective, is often pacification and surveillance. Every keystroke is monitored.
It is an architecture of control disguised as access.
Because the security bureaucracy dictates that the open internet is just too dangerous, right?
Yes. They fear potential communication with victims or criminal networks. So the humanity of genuine educational access is sacrificed for absolute security.
But despite that lockdown, there are incredible educators hacking the system, so to speak. We reviewed Martin Isser's study documenting a virtual web design curriculum taught across correctional facilities.
That was ingenious. Nisser and his colleagues found a way to securely teach actual coding and web design using simulated offline environments.
They proved you can teach complex technical skills without breaching the facility's security protocols.
And then there is the last mile.
Oh, this program is legendary at this point.
It really is. They provide intensive technology and coding education inside prisons, effectively turning incarcerated individuals into highly employable software engineers.
They simulate the tech sector environment inside the facility, but, you know, we have to ask the critical policy question here.
What's that?
Why should state governments fight through the security bureaucracy and allocate funds to teach coding or run bachelor's degree programs for people who broke the law? Because I know exactly what the cynics say. Why should my tax dollars pay for a felon to get a free college degree when I'm still paying off my own student loans?
It is a valid emotional response. We hear it all the time. But the empirical data dismantles the objection entirely.
How so?
The RAND Corporation has published multiple comprehensive analyses over the last decade evaluating the efficacy of correctional education. And the evidence is unequivocal.
Let's look at the actual numbers from RAND.
Participation in correctional education dramatically lowers the odds of recidivism. The meta-analysis shows a reduction in recidivism risk by over 40%.
40%?
Yes. Furthermore, it significantly improves the chances of obtaining post-release employment.
And the cost-benefit analysis is the real kicker for taxpayers. For every dollar a state invests in prison education, it saves between $4 and $5 in future incarceration costs.
It is one of the highest-yield public policy investments available. But what's fascinating here is that the benefits aren't just physical. Education fundamentally transforms the internal culture of the facility itself.
Oh, wow. How does it do that?
Well, when you introduce rigorous academic programming, incidents of violence within the prison actually decrease. It makes the environment safer for the correctional officers and for the incarcerated individuals.
That makes sense.
It shifts the psychology of the space. It stops being a passive warehouse where people simply survive the clock and becomes an active environment where cognitive development and future planning take precedence.
So the logic dictates, if intensive education and cognitive development are the most effective ways to stop criminal behavior and stabilize a life, why are we waiting until someone is locked inside a maximum security facility to provide it?
Exactly. Which leads us directly to the concept of intercepting the pipeline.
Right. We are talking about youth diversion and restorative school practices, basically keeping people out of the system entirely.
The Sentencing Project is a primary authority on this. They argue that our traditional approach to juvenile justice is fundamentally flawed. When a young person commits an offense, the standard protocol is formal court processing.
Right. You arrest them, you assign a public defender, they go before a judge, and they get a juvenile record.
And the research is very clear on the outcome of that process.
Hmm.
Formal system contact itself is criminogenic for youth.
Okay, explain criminogenic in this context.
It means the intervention itself causes more crime.
Wow.
The deeper you pull a young person into the formal justice system, putting them in detention centers with other high-risk youth, severing their ties to their community, branding them with a delinquent identity, the higher the statistical probability that they will reoffend and eventually graduate to the adult system.
It literally becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So diversion is the alternative.
Yeah.
But let's look at how it practically functions, because the Urban Institute documented several specific state models. Rhode Island, for instance, uses juvenile hearing boards.
Right. Instead of a formal courtroom, low-level youth offenses are handled by community panels.
And the focus is on understanding why the behavior occurred and assigning community service or educational tasks rather than putting them on formal probation.
We also saw Idaho utilizing youth assessment centers.
That one was interesting.
Yeah, if a kid gets in trouble, law enforcement can bring them to a center where social workers assess the family dynamics, mental health needs, and underlying trauma. They connect them to services before formal charges are ever filed.
And local municipalities are investing heavily in this. A news report highlighted a $100,000 grant in Midland County, Michigan, designed specifically to launch a diversion program for low-risk youth. The goal is to respond to early misconduct with positive youth development programs.
We even saw this on an international scale.
Oh, right. The Victoria Police in Australia.
Yes. They officially updated their policies to heavily favor cautions and warnings over formal criminal charges for teenagers.
Because they looked at the data and realized that a formal charge was an anchor that dragged kids down, whereas a caution allowed them to course correct without the lifelong burden.
But, you know, we need to address the friction here. Whenever diversion is brought up in public discourse, there's immediate backlash.
Absolutely. The immediate critique is, this is just a slap on the wrist. You're letting teenagers commit crimes with zero consequences. No. What about the victim? Because if someone steals my car, I don't want them sent to a positive youth development program. I want them held accountable.
And that reaction reveals a profound misunderstanding of what genuine restorative diversion actually requires.
How so?
We equate accountability with isolation. But let's look at the reality of a formal juvenile court. It is an incredibly passive, alienating experience for a teenager. They sit silently next to a lawyer.
And the lawyer negotiates with the prosecutor.
Yes, the judge hands down a ruling.
The kid barely speaks. They might spend a few weeks in a juvenile hall feeling angry, victimized by the system, and entirely disconnected from the person they actually harmed.
They serve the time, but they never process the impact of the crime. Now contrast that with a rigorous restorative justice process. True diversion is not letting someone off the hook. It is putting them on the hook for repair.
In a restorative circle, the young person cannot hide behind a lawyer.
No. They have to sit in a room, often face-to-face, with the actual victim of their crime.
Right. They have to listen to the victim explain exactly how the theft or the assault impacted their life, their sense of safety, their finances.
The young person must verbally take responsibility without excuses. And then, collaboratively, they must agree to a rigorous plan to repair the harm.
Which might include restitution, community service, or ongoing dialogue.
Exactly. From a psychological perspective, forcing a teenager to look someone in the eye, acknowledge their pain, and actively work to fix it sounds infinitely more demanding than sitting quietly in a holding cell.
It requires immense emotional and cognitive labor. It forces empathy development, which is the exact mechanism that prevents future offending.
And we are seeing this philosophy move even further upstream, right into the classroom.
The school-to-prison pipeline is so well documented at this point. Resources from the National Education Association and Edutopia outline how schools are fundamentally rethinking discipline.
Historically, schools relied on exclusionary discipline. Zero tolerance policies, automatic suspensions, expulsions.
Which logically makes zero sense. You are acting out and falling behind in class, so our solution is to ban you from the building for 10 days, so you fall further behind and wander the neighborhood unsupervised.
It actively accelerates the path to the justice system. The alternative, profiled by Edutopia, involves restorative practices and healing circles.
So if two students get into a physical altercation, the immediate reaction isn't suspension.
No, the reaction is containment, cooling down, and then bringing the students, their parents, and a facilitator into a circle to uncover the root of the conflict.
Because maybe the fight was about a perceived threat outside of school, or maybe one student is experiencing severe trauma at home and lashing out. The circle addresses the root cause, repairs the relational harm within the school community, and keeps the students connected to their education.
And if you compare the cost of facilitating a school-based restorative circle with the cost of incarcerating that same student in Pelican Bay a decade later,
the economic and moral calculus is undeniable.
Truly undeniable.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time on youth, but adults also end up in the system for issues that aren't inherently malicious. Let's be honest, a vast portion of our criminal legal system is just a holding pen for behavioral health crises.
The criminalization of public health. The Vera Institute's analysis is blistering on this front.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last several decades, as community mental health resources were defunded and affordable housing vanished, society effectively tasked law enforcement with managing the fallout.
Police officers became the default first responders to schizophrenia, profound substance use disorders, and extreme poverty.
And consequently, county jails became the largest mental health facilities in the United States.
I try to explain it with this analogy. Treating addiction or severe mental illness with a jail cell is like trying to cure a broken leg by issuing the patient a parking ticket.
That's exactly what it's like.
It doesn't matter if you write them 10 tickets or lock them up for a month. The bone is still broken. The addiction hasn't been treated. It has only been temporarily contained.
It is an exercise in futility, which is why the framework provided by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, is gaining so much traction among policymakers. They utilize the sequential intercept model.
Let's walk through that model because it is a brilliant way to map the chaos of the system.
So the sequential intercept model conceptualizes the criminal legal system as a series of touch points or intercepts. The goal is to identify points where an individual in a health crisis can be diverted out of the justice system and into the clinical care system.
Okay, so intercept zero is the community level. This is before the police are even called. Mobile crisis teams, suicide hotlines, community drop-in centers.
Right. Then intercept one is law enforcement. If a 911 call is made, does the responding officer have crisis intervention team training? Can they divert the person to a stabilization unit instead of booking them into the county jail?
And if they do get booked, we hit intercept two, which is initial detention and court hearings. This is where we see the huge rise of treatment courts. Organizations like All Rise aggregate the data on these alternative court models.
Traditional courts are adversarial, right? A prosecutor tries to secure a conviction, a defense attorney tries to prevent it, and a judge acts as the referee.
Yeah.
But treatment courts, whether they are drug courts, mental health courts, or veterans treatment courts, operate collaboratively.
The prosecution and defense essentially lay down their weapons.
Yes. They form a team alongside the judge, social workers, and clinical treatment providers.
Yeah.
The participant signs a contract agreeing to intensive, highly monitored treatment, regular drug testing, and frequent appearances before the judge.
And the judge actually acts as a motivator and an accountability partner, rather than just handing down sentences. We saw specific fascinating applications of this. The Laredo Morning Times reported on the Webb County Youth Success Court, which wraps juveniles in substance abuse counseling and family support rather than probation.
Even more profound are the tribal healing to wellness courts. The Tribal Law and Policy Institute outlines how indigenous communities are adapting the treatment court model. They don't just rely on Western clinical therapies, they integrate cultural grounding.
They bring in community elders, traditional peacemaking practices, and indigenous spiritual elements to address the root causes of the behavior.
Because they recognize that for many indigenous populations, substance abuse is deeply tied to historical trauma and cultural dislocation. Healing requires cultural reconnection, not just clinical sobriety.
It is treating the whole person within the context of their community. But we must also look at intercept three, which is jails and prisons. For those who are not diverted, for those who do end up serving time, there is an absolute public health emergency regarding how we handle opioid addiction behind bars.
The Pew Charitable Trusts published a vital brief on this concerning medication-assisted treatment, or MABUP, MAT.
Let's get into this because this feels urgent.
This is perhaps the most urgent life-or-death issue in correctional health right now. Historically, when a person with an active opioid use disorder was incarcerated, facilities forced them into cold turkey withdrawal.
Which is agonizing, but the real danger isn't the withdrawal itself. It is what happens to their brain chemistry while they are inside.
Exactly. Over months or years of incarceration, their biological tolerance to opioids drops entirely to zero.
But the psychological addiction is still very much active.
So the day they are released, they experience the intense stress of reentry, all the civic death barriers we discussed earlier. If they relapse and they use the same dose of fentanyl or heroin they were accustomed to using prior to their arrest,
their body cannot process it.
Right. It is an immediate fatal overdose. Studies show that the risk of overdose death for a formerly incarcerated person in the first 2 weeks post-release is upwards of 120 times higher than the general population.
120 times higher. That is a staggering mortality rate.
Therefore, the implementation of MAT, providing medications like buprenorphine or methadone, which stabilize the brain receptors and prevent cravings and withdrawal inside the facility, is not a luxury.
It fundamentally protects their brain chemistry so that when they are released, their tolerance hasn't plummeted and they are already connected to a community clinic to continue their prescription. It is harm reduction at its most critical level.
Absolutely. We have spent this deep dive moving from the micro-individual housing barriers in specific court models to increasingly macro perspectives. To truly synthesize this, we need to look at the overarching philosophy that binds all these progressive interventions together.
We are zooming out to the philosophy of restorative justice as a holistic framework.
We touched on it during the youth diversion discussion, but restorative justice is not just a program. It is a fundamental paradigm shift in how a society defines justice.
So the traditional system, the adversarial legal system we inherited, essentially asks three questions when an event occurs. What law was broken? Who broke it? And how much pain should the state inflict upon them to balance the scales?
It is deeply transactional. The state is considered the victim. The actual human being who is harmed is relegated to a witness for the prosecution.
Right.
But restorative justice shifts the center of gravity. It asks three entirely different questions. Who was harmed? What are their needs? And whose obligation is it to repair that harm?
It centers the survivor and demands active repair from the responsible party. And we are seeing this deployed not just in small circles, but as a citywide strategy. Look at Oakland's Measure Z, which was evaluated by the Urban Institute.
Oakland utilizes a group violence response strategy. Instead of waiting for violence to occur and then deploying heavy police sweeps that fracture the community, they use proactive violence interruption.
They use credible messengers.
Yes. Individuals who often have their own history with the justice system, who hold credibility and respect on the streets. They intervene in conflicts before they escalate to gunfire.
And they connect individuals at the highest risk of shooting or being shot with intensive life coaching, stipends, and social services.
And there are physical structures dedicated to this ethos, too. The Center for Justice Innovation operates the Red Hook Community Justice Center in Brooklyn.
It is a multi-jurisdictional community court. The judge sits at eye level with the participants. The building houses a clinic, housing support, and youth programs. It treats justice as a neighborhood problem-solving exercise rather than a state-sanctioned exile.
But I know exactly what people might be thinking as they listen to this.
Oh, the pushback.
Yeah. It is one thing to use credible messengers for gang intervention, or a community court for shoplifting, or a healing circle for a teenager who spray-painted a wall. But what about profound violent harm? Can restorative justice handle violence?
It is the ultimate stress test of the philosophy, and the answer is yes, as demonstrated by organizations like Common Justice in New York City.
Their model is revolutionary. They operate a restorative alternative to incarceration specifically for serious violent felonies. We are talking about armed robberies, serious assaults.
And how they do it is critical. First, it requires the explicit consent of the survivor. If the survivor wants a traditional court process, that is what happens.
But many survivors choose Common Justice because the traditional system offers them nothing but a subpoena.
The traditional system puts the offender in a box, but it doesn't answer the survivor's questions. It doesn't guarantee the offender understands the terror they caused.
Exactly. If accepted into Common Justice, the responsible party undergoes an intensive, months-long, highly facilitated process. They must engage in deep accountability dialogues.
They sit with the survivor, they listen to the profound trauma they inflicted, and they are required to meet rigorous, long-term commitments to repair the harm and ensure they never commit violence again.
And if they fail the program or violate the agreements, they are sent back to the traditional court to face their prison sentence. It is incredibly rigorous. The accountability demanded is exponentially higher than simply sitting silently in a cell for 5 years.
And we are seeing this scale internationally. The New Zealand Ministry of Justice has integrated restorative justice and family group conferencing directly into their national court system architecture. It is not an alternative program on the fringe. It is a standard option woven into the fabric of their legal system.
In Colombia, we read about initiatives reforming drug laws, allowing women who are incarcerated as low-level mules to serve community service sentences instead of prison time, prioritizing family cohesion over punishment.
And in Canada, the circles of support and accountability operate in Ottawa, using highly trained community volunteers to surround individuals returning from prison after serving sentences for severe offenses.
They provide a community net that holds the individual accountable while preventing the extreme isolation that often triggers reoffending.
It all connects back to a profound realization about human nature and safety.
It draws heavily upon indigenous peacemaking traditions. The core realization is that true community safety does not generate from physical isolation. You cannot banish a problem permanently.
Right.
True safety comes from social cohesion, mutual accountability, and relationship repair.
We have covered an immense landscape today. We started at the moment of release, looking at the crushing, invisible bureaucracy of the civic death, the thousands of collateral consequences blocking housing and employment. We debated the friction of clean slate laws and the unintended consequences of banning the box.
We journeyed inside the facilities, examining the history of Pell Grants, the paradox of digital literacy on lockdown tablets, and the profound economic return of correctional education.
We moved upstream to intercept the pipeline, looking at the psychological weight of youth diversion and restorative schools. We explored how the sequential intercept model and treatment courts shift our response to addiction and mental illness from punishment to clinical care.
And finally, we examined how restorative justice, even for serious violent felonies, challenges our fundamental assumptions about what accountability actually looks like.
So why does all of this matter to you? We address you directly because you do not live in a vacuum. The success or failure of these highly complex systems dictates the reality of your daily life.
It dictates whether the taxes you pay are funding endless cycles of traumatization or funding actual rehabilitation.
It dictates whether the person moving in next door to you is isolated, desperate, and chemically unstable, or supported, employed, and connected.
These policies shape the moral and physical architecture of the society we all navigate.
We want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over. We began by talking about the absolute precision of a bank loan. For centuries, our society has applied vast resources, rigorous legal structures, and trillions of dollars to design a justice system optimized almost entirely for exclusion.
It is a machine perfected to mark the ledger with a permanent red stain.
But what would happen if we took that exact same level of funding, that same ingenuity, and that same rigorous tracking, and applied it to a system optimized entirely for reintegration? What if every single mechanism from the moment of arrest was engineered to ensure that the individual eventually returns to your neighborhood as a healthy, contributing, fully restored citizen?
It forces us to ask what we actually want from our systems.
Right.
Vengeance or safety.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the structures around you, and we will see you next time.